You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 10th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City on today's Matt and Mike Monday, or Binder and Brooks program, if you prefer. We're going to be talking with Kevin Gastella of Fire Dog Lake about the
Case of the NATO 3. It's a very interesting case. The jury came with their decision on Friday, and we're going to talk to him about what these three people were charged with, why were they being charged, and what now?
Protesters getting charged with terrorism. Talking also with Bob Kincaid, West Virginia radio show host and activist, on what's really happening there with the ongoing crisis caused by Freedom Industries. And really, we're going to want to look at the bigger picture about West Virginia and just the horrible, horrible economics and politics of that state, and how the rest of us enable it by, frankly, dehumanizing a lot of the people of West Virginia. We also got a lot more. We're going to talk about a major DOJ investigation into a Silicon Valley conspiracy to keep engineers' wages down. That implicates your favorite Silicon Valley CEOs and even George Lucas, sad to say, but another in the endless examples in the debunking of the erroneous and silly and childish libertarian worldview.
We also have stories about the latest in the NSA revelations. This one is really something. It's you're going to want to hear this.
The kill list
where the NSA and the drone kill list merge in terms of, I guess, how they work together.
Metadata and carnage on the battlefield.
Also, the CEO of AOL has put his foot in his mouth. And it is pretty shocking. It's pretty amazing.
He's a pretty bad person. Also, Senator Pat Roberts from Kansas has some interesting thoughts about the Indian community in his state, which actually isn't really his state anymore because he actually doesn't live there.
And the NFL will very likely, very soon, have its first openly gay football player.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. Yes. I'm sure we'll get to that in the better half as well. Also, I just want to acknowledge this past weekend in North Carolina, or people were out strong again for Moral Mondays. That's these kind of huge progressive protests going on in North Carolina, fighting back against the onslaught of right-wing policy and vicious austerity in that state. So look, we have a lot coming for you on the show. We're going to make a quick switch. Matt is going to lead the interview with Kevin Gastella, and then Bob Kincaid will join us at about 12:20, or about 20 minutes in. If you're listening later on, thanks so much for listening to Matt and Mike Monday and the Majority Report. We'll be right back.
Always changing things.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Brooks. And on the phone now, we have Kevin Gostola. He is a journalist with FireDogLake.com. And Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I've been following you on this story, and you've been really one of, if not the number one on this case, of the NATO 3, as they're being called. Let's get the audience caught up on this for people who aren't maybe haven't been following this case or aren't as well. Let's just get to a summary of who are the NATO 3 and what were they being charged with?
Yeah, so this case of the NATO 3, and I would presume that most people in this country have never heard of this case because especially since it was prosecuted on the state level here in Illinois. This case of the NATO 3 involved people, their names are Brian Jacob Church, Brent Betterly, and Jared Chase. These are all young men who traveled from Florida at the end of April in 2012. They came to Chicago because they knew that there was going to be a large demonstration planned to protest a NATO meeting that was going to be held here in Chicago. And when they arrived, in just a matter of days, they became the targets of a wide police surveillance operation that was ongoing by the Chicago Police Department, and I presume had support from the FBI, possibly even Homeland Security, Regional Fusion Center, and so in doing security for the upcoming meeting and trying to figure out where to allocate resources so that there could be personnel assigned to handle protests and demonstrations, two undercover police officers named Officer Nadia Chico and Officer Mehmet Egan infiltrated, for lack of a better word, the people here in Chicago, the immediate social network around these men who were here from out of town. And they eventually got a court order on May 4th, 2012 to have a wire device on them, and they were recording conversations, and they were talking to them about what they planned to do around the NATO meeting, and there was, these men were drunk at times, and they were willing to talk about things that I think that people would probably not say out in public, talking about what they would like to do to police. Some of it was violent, but they never actually got them on any recordings plotting any sort of conspiracy. In any case, on May 16th of 2012, they managed to get them involved in the act of making Molotov cocktails with four beer bottles that they put gasoline into. And that night, they were raided. They were arrested along with six other people. And then their three men, their images appeared on television in the 2 days right before the meeting, and they were labeled as terrorists in the media. And then you fast forward to this trial, which I know we'll get into some of the additional details, but we've now had a verdict where a jury returned and found that these men are not terrorists, and they were acquitted of all of the terrorism charges, even though found guilty of other charges related to arson, and they were convicted of mob action. Mm-hmm.
Is it known how the police or the FBI why they decided to go after Church, Betterly, and Chase? How the three of them were singled out for this operation?
Well, what is known is that there was a suspicionless operation that began in February 2012, before the NATO meeting, and originally we thought that this G8 was also going to be held around the same weekend. That was moved by President Barack Obama to Camp David because I presume he couldn't trust Chicago to handle both meetings without there being chaos. And so the reason I'm getting into this is because they were in coffee shops, they were in punk rock shows, they were going to public meetings, meetings of Occupy Chicago. They had people there in plain clothing who weren't, you know, declaring themselves as police officers. They were taking notes of innocent activity protected under the First Amendment of organizing, and they were writing down stuff, and they were looking for people who they thought would pose a risk of violence at the NATO meeting. And this is what we had the two officers admit to and testify during the trial. And so they, through introductions with other activists, these officers all arrived at Betterly Church and Chase when they arrived here in Chicago, and they became the subject of their operation because I think they found that they were willing to talk. They weren't very careful about what they were saying. They were talking about things that they would like to do with different explosives, although I emphasize that there was no plan and they were just talking. And despite the efforts to build a case and produce evidence, the prosecutors in this case did not, in my view, as I was watching the proceedings, show that there was any conspiracy beyond being of this mind that they needed to defend themselves against police, because in their adolescent view of protest, they had seen police attack protesters before, and they thought they needed to wear things like gas masks, or they needed to prepare to defend themselves when they were going to be attacked by police at the NATO meeting protests. And that, I think, influenced them. And also on May 9th, I will add, while they were here in Chicago, they were stopped in a baseless stop by police, and one of the officers threatened to beat their skulls in with a billy club, just like 1968, the Democratic National Convention. So the animosity that they had felt as they were being targeted had some merit, had some justification.
Mm-hmm. So with the undercover officers, Nadia and Mehmet, can you go into a little bit of how they brought these three along for certain, were the ideas planted into them? Did they come here with the idea of, you know, doing something specific? Could you go into a little bit of what the undercover officers' influence was over what exactly was going on?
Yeah, so these officers started out allegedly with going after Brian Jacob Church, and before they had a wired device, on May 2nd, they met him at a restaurant called the White Palace Grill, and he sat down and he asked them, you know, obviously not knowing that they're police, to take out the batteries in their cell phones, and he did. And then they claim, and we have none of this on tape, this is all based off the credibility of these officers. You know, if you trust these people, then you believe what they said. Mm-hmm. But if you see in testimony that they have been less than forthright in their answers, then you might question the story that has been created. Because when Church arrives, we had a surveillance photo of Church arriving. But this, what they said on the stand is there was this wild story of how Church had said, you know, the city doesn't know what it's in for, and after NATO, it will never be the same. They say he said, are you ready to see a cop on fire? And then led them down to the downtown area around the Chase Bank Tower. They told this wild story of, like, how he put his hand on the glass to test the thickness, because for some absurd reason that might help you figure out how to launch an attack on the bank tower. And then he was walking up and down. There's an atrium by the tower in downtown Chicago. He was walking up and down steps, looking for an entry point for his attack, mapping out surveillance cameras. So they tell this story, the prosecutors and the undercovers, of what Church was planning to do, and we have no evidence to corroborate it, nothing in writing, really, that would seem to be immediately confirm this. And then in the course of them going after these people up through May 16th, they don't ever get them to do anything. They're not able to convince them to even do recon on Obama's headquarters. I mean, the allegations essentially are that they were planning to attack police stations. They were planning to attack Obama's reelection campaign headquarters in downtown Chicago, and they were trying to, or had a plan to light a police officer on fire, or they wanted to go after a bank or even a neighborhood bank branch where they were staying in Chicago. And they couldn't even prove that they had even done recon on Obama's headquarters and knew where it was located. They couldn't prove that they had even done the basic beginnings of these plans. And so on May 16th, they finally, Egan says he's got $2 to go buy gasoline for Molotov cocktails, and Chase goes along with him to a BP gas station, and they get some gasoline, and they come back, and on that day, the officers, the undercover officers, are the first ones to raise the issue of making Molotov cocktails, and then they're on the porch, and they fill the bottles three-quarters of the way with gasoline, four of them. Church is on the other end of the porch, not really involved in the act. Federally, they can't actually prove that where he was. The defense attorneys say he was inside the house and are insistent. The prosecutors say he was sitting on steps and was giving instructions. But if you ask the officers, they don't really know where he was, so it's not clear that he's part of the act. And they know that Chase was pouring gas, so he's more culpable in this instance. But Egan cuts the wicks. He cuts the bandanas that are put into the bottles in order to make them, and then he possesses. He takes the bottles and he puts them in his backpack. And they, the NATO 3, never ever have control of these made Molotov cocktails. And now, even though they were acquitted of terrorism charges, they were convicted of this possessing of an incendiary device with the intent to commit arson. And that is an offense, a major felony that could be a potential sentence of up to 30 years in prison for each of them. So, but they had never really had an opportunity to control this incendiary device.
So it sounds like what the case really was hoping for, what the state's case was really hoping for was that the jury would obviously believe the police officer's side of the story over these three protesters. So, and I know you were present for the trial. Can you take us in and just give us a little bit about what was going on from inside the courtroom? How was the jury taking things? What the police officers were saying?
What I would emphasize is that this is a fantasy of radical terror that was brought into the courtroom by prosecutors. And they had created this narrative about these three men. And this is very serious. I actually am going to take a quick moment to go up to the trial just so people can understand how these men were treated. You know, now that they've been acquitted by a jury, they were labeled terrorists before, in the early phases, in the hearings, in the first hearing after they were arrested, one of the first, they're brought in shackles and chains into a courtroom, and they don't even do this to murderers. They were brought in shackles and chains. Their bail is set at $1.5 million. The state had actually wanted bail for each of them to be set at $5 million. because they said these are dangerous terrorists. Okay, they were held in protective custody in Cook County Jail here in Chicago, which means essentially they're subjected to some conditions that are very similar to solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now they've been acquitted. And the reason they were acquitted is because there's no evidence to support this being a terrorism case.
And yet, I want to quickly just add that this is I mean, the whole idea of this case was hinging on the convicting them of terrorism and the state lost.
Right. Yeah. It was under the state terrorism law that they prosecuted these people. However, it has the markings of a federal case, and a key wrinkle to this is that the federal government did not prosecute these men, and I think it's because the Secret Service couldn't confirm the threat to Obama's campaign headquarters.
Mm.
So in the trial, what you had is these charges of material support for terrorism and charges of conspiracy to commit terrorism and the possession offense, the possession of an incendiary device with the intention to commit terrorism. And they had no basis for bringing those charges, and they couldn't prove those in the courtroom. And they wove this incredible story on the last day of the proceedings and closing argument of how they were providing material support, and talked about the different things of, like, you had currency, so that's material support, because they scraped together some funding to buy the gas, to do gas jugging, because they did gas jugging all the way up from Florida to Chicago, and Brent Beverly has a food stamp card, and they had public assistance, and they had a guy who they hoped would do a Western Union transfer of cash to them so they could help get themselves to Chicago, and they kept going down this list of, like, lodging and training. The training was apparently 3 minutes where they talked to each other about how to de-arrest, which is like when the police want to arrest you and you say you're going to do some kind of defensive maneuver to get the police off of you, and they remove the person who's being arrested and bring them to safety. They only did that for like 3 minutes. So how does that count as Al-Qaeda militarized type training, you know? And So they weave this incredible narrative, and they had nothing to back it up. And they called these men terrorists in the courtroom, and they even gave them terror-sounding nicknames. I'll just quickly say that they called the one guy, Brent Beverly, was Professor Molotov.
Wow.
Jared Chase was Captain of Napalm, and Jacob Church was Mr. Cop on Fire himself. Very inflammatory.
Wow.
And the jury didn't buy into any of this. They came back and they stood up to the fear and the innuendo that was thrown in their face by these prosecutors and saw the case for what it should have been brought as. In the initial phase, it should have been brought as a case of, did these guys intend to commit arson?
I mean, I think it's amazing with this case is that, I mean, it shows that a jury, you know, essentially United States citizens are able to tell what is and isn't a terrorist. And they saw that these three kids essentially were not engaging in terrorist acts. And I think it's an interesting case. And I know they were charged with, what was it they were charged with again? One was solicitation to commit arson. What was the other?
Yeah, they had possession of an incendiary device with intent to commit arson, was what they were convicted of.
And so when do the sentences from that come down?
So the sentencing for them is not scheduled yet. They have a date coming up on February 28th. But I guess the main takeaway from this is that I believe that the jury got the idea that terrorism was being trivialized.
Yes.
And that was very clear from the defense attorneys.
Kevin Gustola, Fire Dog Lake, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We will take a quick break, and then we will have Michael talking about what's going on in West Virginia with activist Bob Kincaid.
And them say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. I and I start recruit, soldiers for Selassie army. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, welcome the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. You're not for oxygen, are the general issue in a warning.
Georgia people, them a ball, said them tired of mediocre. Evil a go fall when we chat in Ethiopia. Me leaving from Dan, cause them life no easy boat, yeah. Even Bantan said it's not an easy road. Operation, occupy the motherland. Calling all soldiers to kindly chat along. From creation, he writing a job plan, but chronics can't do it alone. So I'm recruiting soldiers coming from near and far, I choose. Executing Selassie I works and the lust of our right truth. And them say here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Sent by the savior, welcome the Rasta youth. I'm an a start recruit, soldiers for Selassie I army. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Welcome the savior, welcome the Rasta youth. You're not for oxygen, who are the general issue in a warning boy. Waving the banner red, green and gold. It is such a honor for season four. Discovered on stones, on trees and scrolls. And even in the stories that Jesus told. Rasta youth must inherit the earth. Can't sit down, Jaja send me if you work. Bring the fire in a room, Jaja send me if you purge. But I can't do it alone. Rasta recruiting soldiers coming from near and far, I choose. Executing Selassie I works and be lost afar, I choose. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Sent by the savior, welcome the Rasta youth. I and I start recruit soldiers for Selassie I army, hey. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger. Welcome the savior, welcome the Rasta youth. You know fi ask is who are the general issue in a warning, eh? Left or right, the soldiers are gone. Left, right, the soldiers are gone. Eh, could I never throw it down, no boy. Yeah, how we say left, right, the soldiers are gone. Left, right, the soldiers are gone. Left, right, the soldiers are gone. Marching on, boy. How we say, here comes trouble, my friend, and here comes danger. Rastafari, send me come, I say we're sent by the Savior. Here comes trouble, my friend, here comes danger. Whoa, ooh, nah. Hey, and then say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, here comes trouble.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining me now is Bob Kincaid. He's a host at the Progressive Radio Network, Head On Radio. And he's also, I'm sorry, Bob, it's the Community Health. Could you tell me your second affiliation, Bob? I'm sorry.
Sure. The Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, the AIC campaign, AIC.org.
Thank you so much, Bob. And I'm very glad you're on today because I already see, and I think we all already see, the kind of mainstream media moving away from what's happening in West Virginia, this ongoing, very specific crisis of Freedom Industries, and they're kind of making water unsafe for many citizens of West Virginia, essentially. But I also know, obviously, through your work and what you do from Appalachian Health to working on mining issues and really the kind of broad context of what's happening in West Virginia, you can not only kind of bring us up to date on what's happening, but also really contextualize the overall picture in West Virginia, which is very appalling in my view. So, but I guess let's start with Where do things stand now in terms of what's happening in the state and what people are being told about the safety of their drinking water and the reality of the safety of their drinking water?
Well, there's certainly no consensus right now, Michael, as to whether or not the water is safe.
Right.
And I don't think my opinion is that we're still not even asking the right questions about all of this. You know, we had 10,000 gallons of a chemical that is largely, that we know next to nothing about, dumped in the public water drinking supply. Of course, it's a chemical that's used in the coal preparation process. That's why Governor Earl Ray Tomlin had to run out at the beginning of this thing a month ago and say, now, this has nothing to do with the coal industry.
Oh, nothing.
When in reality, it has everything to do with the coal industry. That's why the West Virginia Coal Association, the Friends of Coal, tweeted, if it's good enough to wash coal, it's good enough to wash me. That was the day of the disaster.
That's astounding.
And let's put it this way. We're talking about a 9-county area with 300,000 customers. Remember, they're not citizens. They're customers of the for-profit West Virginia American Water Company who have largely gotten a pass in this. Everybody wants to look at Freedom Industries and what a bunch of obvious ne'er-do-wells they were. And they were, and they are. But the fact of the matter is West Virginia American Water Company didn't shut down. They didn't stop the water from flowing. And for at least, and if you talk around town, I happened to be on a plane going into Charleston from Atlanta last night, just talking with a lot of people from the area, and they were talking about the fact that they'd been smelling the stuff for a couple of days before the disaster was announced.
Right.
So we really don't know how long and how much of this stuff went into the water, and the scientists don't know much about how to deal with it. And so as a consequence, we're also learning that it's very difficult to get rid of. So one question is, what if the entire water system has to be replaced? I mean from the mains out, because there's reason to think that this stuff clings to water systems such that you never really get rid of it. You know, here it was just a few days ago that the one woman fainted, other kids were taken to the hospital at a public school, Michael.
Right, right.
Okay. And because we know so little about this chemical, we also know next to nothing about what its long-term effects are. So, for instance, we know that on the day of the spill, there were somewhere between 8 hours at least in which the governor of West Virginia sat on his hands, did nothing, except maybe consult with people in the industries that matter to him about how he should approach this.
And that's a really crucial point. I just want to jump in for a moment, Bob, because I've seen you actually make this point before, and I'd love you to draw this connection now. If there had been a terrorist group operating in West Virginia, or a report that an affiliate of Al-Qaeda had dropped a deadly chemical into public drinking water and people being rushed to the hospital, this would have been a national, even global emergency, arguably. What you're saying is that when Freedom Industries did this and the local water authorities did this, the governor just sort of sat on his hands and consulted. And I actually have some more recent quotes from the governor about the safety of the drinking water. He said this on January 20th. He said, "It's up to residents to decide whether or not they use the water. It's your decision. I'm not going to say absolutely 100% that everything is safe, but what I can say is if you don't feel comfortable, don't use it." I mean, what the hell does that mean?
I have no idea, because does that mean just stop being a water-based animal?
Right. He's like, one option
because
is to
are.
Stop being a human being, right?
Exactly. And let's carry that out a little bit further, Michael. It was a big deal that they were anti-regulation. We understand that. But they came up with a tank regulation bill, right? Are we all dutifully impressed? And then it came out that before the bill was introduced to the public, that he had a meeting with stakeholders. Now, when you're talking about poisoned water, and I think stakeholders, I'm thinking about the mama who's making a bottle of formula for her baby.
Literally,
I'm thinking about the school cook who's making lunch for a whole bunch of elementary school kids. That's what a stakeholder sounds like to me, or people who just happen to have public water flowing through their faucets. But no, the stakeholders that Earl Ray Tomlin met with were the West Virginia Coal Association and the West Virginia Oil and Gas Association and the West Virginia Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Well, I mean, it seems to tell us sort of everything we need to know. Moving off of that, so we know that this situation is at best far from clear. This seems to be a kind of very clear path into what you've been talking about for a long time, which is really that the political leadership of West Virginia is completely compromised by these industries, and there really is where besides obviously you and people you work with, is there any aspect of state government or government or governance in West Virginia that is acting on behalf of the public, or is this really a totally compromised system and really a small, an active and strong civil and activist society, but with very few allies in actual government in West Virginia? I mean, where are West Virginia's representatives? I see Joe Manchin on TV talking about, cutting Social Security occasionally, but I haven't really seen him talk very much about this.
No, see, if I can sort of expand the discussion a little
bit, Michael.
Absolutely,
please.
To give you an idea, you mentioned the AIC campaign, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign.
Yes.
Well, we've got the only bill in Congress that would end mountaintop removal, and we'll say, hopefully, your listeners know what mountaintop removal is. It is a toxic, deadly process that has been shown to be making a whole lot of people very sick in mountaintop removal communities. There are over 20 studies, you can read them at acheact.org, acheact.org. There are over 20 studies talking about coal and particularly mountaintop removal's impacts on human health. We have been trying for years now to get Joe Manchin to acknowledge that those studies even exist.
Right.
He will not even, not that they're right or wrong, he will not even acknowledge that they exist, okay? When the cancer study came out, someone asked Governor Tomlin about the study showing increased cancer rates in mountaintop removal communities. Governor Tomlin's response, and we now see it to be part of a pattern, because when people were going to the hospital with this most recent disaster, he had his people come out and say it was because of flu season. Well, when the cancer study survey was mentioned to him, Earl Ray Tomlin's response was to say, well, every day somebody says something else makes you sick. Okay. There are, for instance, if we want to talk about regulating tanks with these chemicals in it, okay, how about 126 toxic waste impoundments in the state of West Virginia, 19 in two counties alone, all right? And they hold billions and billions, literally, of gallons of toxic waste behind impoundments that are just made of dirt and rock. Add to this the fact, you talk about who can we look to protect us in West Virginia in government. Well, the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection has allowed coal companies to blast within mere hundreds of feet of these dams holding back these billions of gallons of waste.
Well, this sounds like a great libertarian society. But, so it actually strikes me as you're talking that there's sort of two core dangers in terms of how this story can play out on a national stage. Obviously, the main dangers are, of course, the immediate crisis of public health in West Virginia. But I think nationally, I mean, one which we're already seeing, which I mentioned at the outset of this conversation, is this story sort of receding in the news and getting less attention, even though it's obviously an ongoing emergency. And then another, which I think we see a lot, obviously we know Freedom Industries is a horrible company run by, as you say, I like ne'er-do-wells, and the notion of them declaring bankruptcy and not being accountable for these actions is obviously very problematic, to say the least. But at the same time, if we look at this crisis through the lens of, oh, these bad guys at Freedom Industries, and we kind of can compartmentalize it like that, we're not going to really see the kind of statewide crisis of public health and accountability that you're talking about.
It's not even statewide, yeah. Michael. It is region-wide, okay? Yeah. For instance, the largest of these impoundments I was talking about is the Brushy Fork impoundment, 9 billion gallons. When that dam breaks, and they all leak, okay, let's understand this, they all leak. When that one breaks, it is estimated at least a 40-foot wall of toxic waste is going to travel the entirety of the Coal River Valley. It's going to kill everything and everyone. But on top of that, as if that was not bad enough, it's going to empty into the Kanawha River, the same place that the MCHM dumped into. Remember when Cincinnati shut off their intakes?
Yeah.
Okay. The Kanawha empties into the Ohio empties into the Mississippi, and hello, New Orleans. Okay. We're talking about We're talking about the water supply for the entire southeastern United States. It arises in the Appalachian Mountains, and for better than a decade and a half now, the coal industry has done everything it possibly can to liquidate Appalachia, and in the process sort of hang fire on the water sources for millions and millions of people. This is no longer a neglectable hillbilly problem. This is an American problem, and it had better be understood as such, because it's coming a lot of other people's way.
Absolutely, and I use that phrase, a neglectable hillbilly problem, and I think, again, from a national standpoint, and this is something that's always really upset me, frankly, when we talk about West Virginia and Appalachia as a whole, that it seems to me that the kind of obviously, we're talking about a political crisis. We're talking about corporations that are completely sort of owning the process, I've already put many people's lives and health in jeopardy, and now jeopardizing a much larger part of the country, as you say. And then it seems that the sort of soft corollary of that is just what you say. It's sort of like we have these endless jokes about parts of the country like Appalachia and West Virginia. People don't really take it seriously. They don't take the time that could be taken to kind of connect with the human stakes and the human lives on the ground in these places. And I don't want to overstate the point, but it just seems to me that there's a very important correlation about the kind of national dismissal and at times even just mockery of Appalachia with the reality of what that region plays in our national economy and politics, which is really a core point of dangerous extractive industries, essentially.
Well, do you realize, Michael, that in the last 100 years, something on the order of 100,000 people in Appalachia have given their lives for the rest of the country?
Yes.
In various forms of coal disasters, coal crises, and coal-borne diseases. Yes. And that's not even counting the innocents, okay? We're talking about working people in blow-ups, cave-ins,
yes,
fires, what have you.
Yes.
There's a reason we refer to this as the sacrifice zone. And, the scant attention that is paid to Appalachia is really kind of shameful because, for instance, if there were 126 multi-billion-gallon toxic waste sludge impoundments in New York State, there would be a riot.
Absolutely.
Not that I'm advocating that. But people will tolerate things being done to Appalachia because we are forgettable, that they will not tolerate anywhere else. Can you imagine if 9.8 billion gallons of toxic waste were sitting behind a dirt and rock impoundment looming over San Diego?
Well, I mean, I couldn't even imagine it because it's literally inconceivable that it would happen. And I think that that's what's so kind of essential and upsetting about this is that it's not there's this history that we don't even know. The 100,000 number, I think, would shock a lot of people. And then, there's this kind of there is a certain kind of cultural mockery and dismissal of these zones of sacrifice.
Consider this one statistic, Michael.
Yeah.
We know, for instance, from studies of birth defects that were done of the region, live birth statistics from 1996 to 2003, we know that a woman who is pregnant and lives in a mountaintop removal area but does not smoke, in other words, she's being a good mommy-to-be, she's got 181% greater chance of giving birth to a baby with respiratory birth defects than a woman who's pregnant and smokes but does not live near mountaintop removal.
Right.
And understand, with this current crisis with the MCHM, that stuff has been transported to coal prep plants all over southern West Virginia and central Appalachia generally, I suppose. And it's part of what is pumped into these sludge dams because it doesn't last forever. It's used in the process, and then when it's used up, they pump it away because they have no other way of dealing with the massive amounts of waste, the toxic waste that this industry produces. So if you can, those 8 hours still terrify me, Michael. They terrify me. What are we going to learn in 10 to 15 years about what happened to people who drank or used or bathed in whatever MCHM and PPH and, for all we know, formaldehyde-laden water? What are we going to find out about them in 10 to 15 years' time? But see, that's the way it works around here. Because 10 to 15 years later, when you get yourself a cancer cluster, people say, well, just like Earl Ray Tomlin said, well, every day somebody says something else makes you sick. We should not pay for our lives or pay with our lives for the simple act of living somewhere in America. And that's why I've said for a very long time that until things like mountaintop removal are ended outright, no one who lives in central Appalachia in the sacrifice zone can consider themselves to be a fully vested American citizen. Because you don't just kill people for money. And that's what's going on here. I mean, some wag, and it was sort of a bit of black humor, said, you know, if a terrorist had done to West Virginia what a corporation did, we'd have already bombed the wrong country by now.
Oh, God, that's brilliant and depressing on so many levels. How does this – I want you to quickly go into how this crisis relates, and obviously this is the important kind of theme of this conversation as well. How does this kind of illuminate the destructive myth of clean coal?
Well, understand that it is a myth, and beyond a myth, it's an advertising slogan. My friend Jeff Biggers tells me that it first appeared as an advertising slogan, I think, in a Chicago newspaper in the early 1900s. Because people have, for instance, we've known black lung kills since like 1831, the mid-19th century, and yet we're still losing 1,000 people a year to black lung disease, an entirely preventable condition. There is no clean coal. There is no way to make coal clean. It will never be clean because you can never ever acquire it cleanly. For instance, there's a story out of Wyoming about an outfit from Australia that wants to try a new coal gasification project. Sit down, okay? They want to set fire to the coal under the ground and let it burn underground and siphon the gases off from it.
Oh, that sounds.
They need a waiver to poison an entire portion of an aquifer in order to do it. That's the nature of this industry. They care nothing for the well-being of human populations that live near where they get it, because it gets in the way of the money. And the only way this is ever profitable, Michael, is if we continue to externalize the costs onto innocent human beings.
Right.
Which is, you know, West Virginia has been America's canary in the coal mine for 100 years, and the canary's not doing too good.
Well, no, and I think that's because we use this phrase. We talk about privatizing the gains, socializing the losses, which sums up a lot. But this, you know, even that phrase in some ways can be too kind of antiseptic, in it, you know, too kind of clean in a way. I mean, this is literally the privatizing of gain and the socializing of death, essentially. As a final question, and maybe also you can answer in this final question, because I know we'll get some IMs and some calls of people sort of with the, you know, this is the only way people can find work sort of talking point. What is a real agenda for people who care about Appalachia and the people of and the people in the sacrifice zone, and really, of course, the country as a whole, because obviously this has many national implications? What needs to be done to avert this crisis and get things where they need to be?
There needs to be an outcry to get the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act passed. It's H.R. 526. It's in the Congress right now. It needs to be introduced in the Senate, okay? And it needs to be passed into law. Because until we stop mountaintop removal, I mean, mountaintop removal is the toxic rose on top of a very thorny spine. Mm. And if we can end mountaintop removal, and the AIC Act does it, and it does it through a combination of a moratorium on new permits and a fully funded federal study of all of these health impacts, if we can do that, then we can begin to see what it looks like to try to heal Appalachia. That's the most important thing people can do. I encourage people, Michael, to go to AICACT.org, click on the science tab, read the scientific reports of all of the horrors that are foisted upon people just because they live near mountaintop removal. Then get active. You know, we've got a tab there where you can contact your member of Congress. We've got over 40 people on this bill right now, but we need a whole lot more. And as I said, we need it introduced in the Senate. And frankly, until such time as the AIC Act becomes the driving force here, everything else has a sort of Band-Aid quality to it. The bill that Joe Manchin's talking about in the Senate is not going to answer the question of human health in Appalachia and why people have to be diseased just because they're living where their families have lived for 200 years and a coal company showed up next door one day.
Well, absolutely. And we'll put a link to AICACT.org on the Majority Report website. People should definitely take a look at it, sign the petition, get involved. Bob Kincaid, thank you so much for joining us today. I really, really appreciate your time and your work.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for the opportunity to talk about this issue, because it deserves much more than what it's getting.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Michael. Bye now.
All right, folks.
We are out of time.
We are out of time. We're going to move into what I promise will be a funner second half of the show.
That was quite the first half. Yeah,
very intense.
Yes.
Covering a lot of bases there. You know, that you will not get in most outlets. That just think about that interview with Bob Kincaid. Think about Kevin Gastola explaining what was really going on with the NATO 3 case. I mean, I barely even knew about the NATO 3 case, frankly. I mean, that's the kind of granular...
Yeah, it was really barely covered even by most online media outlets.
Oh, yeah. Most of the stuff that... Because we check, you know, we read the New York Times, BBC, whatever, but then we look at Fire Dog Lake, Democracy Now!, we look at everything all day. And, you know, even a story like that might still not get pushed to the front. And we're able to cover that story. We're able to have Bob Kincaid tell you what's really going on. This is, of course...
And you know why we're able to do that?
Because of members.
Like you.
Like you.
A little bit of PBS action right there.
Yeah, exactly. And like you, soon-to-be members, because we know that you're going to come along and see the light. It's less than a coffee a day. It's a matter of, really, a couple of cents. What is it, 33 cents a day?
It's less than that.
Less than that. $10 a month. Of course, you can do more if you're so moved, but please become a member. That's how this whole thing is possible.
And not only do you get to have the whole show even possible by becoming a member, because without members, the free half isn't even possible.
Indeed.
You also, though, by becoming a member, get all these amazing stories coming up in the better half. Why don't you tell us what we're going to be talking about, Michael?
Well, I'm going to be talking about a major Silicon Valley price gouging scheme, essentially, on their own employees, which implicates all of your favorite heads of Silicon Valley. So I'll be talking about that. Going to be talking about also this new Lego movie has upset Fox News. That should be fun. I'm sure we'll also get to I'm sorry, his name's escaping me, but the NFL will have its
Michael
first.
Sam.
Michael Sam. You know, that's what, you know what confused me is because his last name is Sam. I obviously associate that with the first name.
What's that guy's name whose first and last name is both the name of the host of the show and a producer on the show? I can't quite remember his name. Oh, yes. Michael Sam.
Ah, indeed. Okay. That's,
I mean,
that's
if his middle name is Matt,
that's one way.
Pretty much.
That's one way of doing it. So we'll get to that. We'll also, what else we got? We got a bunch more.
We have the story that's coming out of the latest NSA revelation where they are, the United States is using the metadata that the NSA, rallies up to use as their intelligence for drone strikes on the kill list, which is just, it's amazing to me that
it
they
is,
are doing
it's a
that.
Pretty...
And we'll talk about that more in the better half. Also, hopefully we'll be able to get to this too. The AOL, the CEO of AOL is putting his foot in his mouth unlike he has ever done so before.
And you can call us. The IM is on. Call us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can download the app.
At MajorityApp.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at MajorityFM. Like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/MajorityReport. Subscribe to us on YouTube, YouTube.com/SamCedar. Subscribe to our live account on YouTube, which is YouTube.com/MajorityReportLive. You can buy your junk through our Amazon link by just going to MajorityReportKickback.com, and that'll take you right to Amazon using our affiliate link. And we will see you all in the better...
The better funner half. That's a special Matt and Mike edition, the better funner half.
Or Binder and Brooks.
Binder and Brooks.
Attorneys of law.
Yeah. Binder and Brooks, LLC. Okay. We'll be right back. We hold on.